Some say we're on the verge of a great awakening. Others claim the powerful Puppet Master's multifaceted stranglehold is stronger than ever. And on the Higher Side Chats, we explore the conspiracies, the mysterious, the alternative, and the occult, on a quest that rests firmly on the fringe, which won't be sponsored by Audible or Stamps.com, nor picked up by the gatekeepers of conventional media or radio. It's a quest of the people. So if you enjoyed this first free hour of THC, consider sponsoring the journey yourself by subscribing at thehiresidechatsplus.com. Just $5 a month gets you a second hour with all our great guests on each of our month's five shows. You can also make your own topic and guest suggestions right on your THC Plus profile, communicate with Greg Carlwood, and have your own custom RSS feed URL to use and still listen on the majority of popular podcast applications. You can also support the show with a donation into the THC Money Bomb, where on the last show of every month, we give half of the total donations back to one of the random listeners like you who could use a nice surprise in these troubled times. And lastly, to support THC in a free and equally important way, share the show with your friends, review us where you can, and join us in the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, and our subreddit forum, where THC fans and the cerebral adventurers of the counterculture have taken refuge and discuss the finer points of our never-ending struggle to tip the scales in favor of truth, peace, and enlightenment in a war-torn, corrupt, and shady world. Let the games begin.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, getting the wheels thoroughly greased for the weirdness ahead. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and today is a ride through the hidden history of banking, Atlantis, our alien gods, and a trip along several random branches of the Conspira tree, with a romp through anomalous aspects of the moon and the hollow nature of several bodies in the solar system, the pyramids, and a whole lot more. So I hope you have those seats and tray tables in the upright locked position, because we're not screwing around here. One of my favorites of all time was gracious enough to join the ranks of the powerhouses I feel like I've been lucky enough to talk to while doing this show, and there were just so many things I wanted to get Jim to weigh in on, and in my classic ADD fashion, we are all over the map, but that's what I think makes this so much fun. But before we pull out of the gate, as most of you know, every month I give half of the THC donations away to one of the listeners in the Money Bomb, the only bombs I like to drop. It's the power of microtransactions and community, and that's what we're about. That's what supports me and the show, and each month it helps one of the listeners who are a bit like family in spirit. So I think we can all say that anyone who enjoys the same fringe topics as we do has got to be A-OK on some level. So I picked a winner for October. His money bomb was just over $300, something like $315 or so, and he left me a message in the traditional fashion on the voicemail app at thehiresidechats.com, which I encourage you guys to do too if you have interesting stories or compelling theories. And I'm going to play his message. It seems like it really made a difference for him, so that's awesome. And then on the other side of that, we're diving into the deep end of the pool to explore many of the strange or corrupt aspects of history and the present that have been omitted from the timeline and how these things connect with the Godfather himself, Jim Mars.
Hey everybody, this is Chris from Atlanta, Georgia, the October Money Bomb winner. Huge thanks to everybody involved with THC and all the supporting listeners. Very much in shock that I won this. As far as what I plan to do with the money, I've been saving to get out of a job I'm not so crazy about, and this will finally allow me to move on with my life. Very excited about that. I'm obviously going to be a longtime supporter of the show, and definitely going to pick up some conspiracies along the way. First show I saw was the Robert Phoenix episode that kind of lured me in, and I've been digging through the archives ever since. Really enjoyed Duncan Trussell, Lennon Honor, Wendy Tremaine was extremely enlightening. Pretty much everything you touch on. You've done a great job finding guests that I've never heard of that have a really cool message. Like to say to all the people out there that are on the fence about donating, the chances are pretty good of winning the money bomb, it turns out, and you get to support young Carlwood in the process. I think it's kind of a no-brainer. Once again, thanks to everybody involved. Cheers, guys.
Folks, we know that several of the tools used by the nefarious elite to control and enslave the masses today are as old as time itself. Coupled with stories from cultures all around the globe that speak of superior beings from the sky that brought them knowledge, built society around their plan, and might have even built humanity itself, one can't help but wonder how connected these ancient sky visitors are to the puppet string pullers of today. And lucky for us, today's guest has been dusting for prints and prying up the floorboards longer than I've been alive. He's an investigative journalist and author from Fort Worth, Texas, who has written several best-selling books on a plethora of my favorite topics, from Alien Agenda and the Trillion Dollar Conspiracy to Rise of the Fourth Reich and our occulted history. The man who knows the plan, the Papa Bear of the conspiracy movement, and one of my favorite researchers on the scene today, Jim Mars. Welcome to THC.
Hey, Greg, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. But we both know that the pleasure is mine. You are one of the greats, and what an awesome time to have you on. There is so much madness in this crazy world right now. Ebola scares, updates to the Georgia Guidestones, a standoff with the cops in Ferguson, and the tightening of the screws of this global debt-based system of rule. Jim, it's out of control, and it makes it hard to know where to even start.
That's true. Well, you know, as the last of a dying breed, I consider myself a generalist. I know a little bit about a whole lot of things, you know, and I don't claim to be an absolute expert in anything. But unfortunately, that's what we need today, because as you just pointed out, there's so much going on, and we're such a highly specialized society now. Doctors know doctoring, lawyers know the legal system. You know, everybody's into their own little thing, and I think that what's missing is somebody with an overview to try to catch what's going on. But I don't know. I think so many things bother me today. The rise of ISIS in the Middle East, which turns out is simply basically just the old Muslim Brotherhood, which was originally a Nazi-run organization during World War II and then handed over to the British when the Nazis were defeated. And then the British handed it over to the CIA. And so we've been running them ever since. They could not use the term Muslim Brotherhood when we wanted to confront the Russians in Afghanistan back in the 80s. So they changed the name to the Mujahideen, or the Freedom Fighters. And then they brought their leader, the Saudi Osama bin Laden, over to this country under an assumed name, and gave him arms, ammunition, training, money, sending back to fight against the Russians in Afghanistan, but changed the name to Al-Qaeda. And then, but then after 9/11, they decided that wasn't going to fly much anymore. So now it's ISIS, but it's all the same bunch of Arab mercenaries and minions that they can recruit over there and get to do their will, and the whole purpose is to just create chaos in the Middle East so that we continue to have control over the oil resources and the gas pipelines.
Right.
And not to mention keeping the poppy fields going for the heroin trade.
Yes.
In Afghanistan. You know, prior to our invasion of Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, ostensibly to go, just simply go and try to capture Osama bin Laden. It was widely reported, particularly in the European media, that the Taliban, and I don't have a whole lot of good to say about them, but they were religious fanatics, and they had destroyed 95% of the heroin crop over there, the poppy crop, okay? And so we went in there. How hard would it have been to simply go ahead and destroy the other 5%? And then, you know, that would have been the end of the major heroin supply in the world. But instead, within a year, they were all back into poppy cultivation. And then I read a piece the other day where this year they're having a bumper crop. Okay. So they got to keep the drugs flowing. And of course, I don't think anybody's going to be able to prove that leaders of the United States, and I'll name the Clintons, and I'll name the Bushes, nobody's going to be able to prove that they are behind the drug trade. But what is known and well documented is that these families like that, and plus many others, the wealthy elite, depend on the drug money flowing through the banking industry to make them millions and millions of dollars every right. year. So although we supposedly have been in a war on drugs since the Nixon years, obviously that war is long lost, and it's more talk than actual action. For example, if there was a true war on drugs and they wanted to stop the illegal drug trade, it would be simple enough to go through the banking system, identify the drug money that's crossing through there, and put a stop to it. But of course, they'll never do that.
No, of course not. They got to get their drug money. But man, you are so good at identifying and tracking this tangled web of changing names and power centers and following it throughout time. It gets confusing for me, but that's the way they like it. One other thing that's on the minds of a lot of listeners, I think, is probably Ebola. It's about what half the emails I get are about, and I can't tell if it's just a media fear campaign, a legitimate concern, or part of something bigger. What are your thoughts on this whole Ebola thing?
Well, I'm kind of on the fence myself. I think it's one or the other. You know, it's either going to be another swine flu, bird flu, H1N1, where there's a whole lot of fear-mongering and a whole lot of vaccine sales and a whole lot of public control that turns out to be for not much of anything, or it may turn out to be the zombie apocalypse, you know, that kills off everybody. I guess we'll just have to kind of wait and see, but I will say right off the top that there's too many questions about it. The testing for Ebola is very questionable. It seems to be only by one test, and only the CDC has that. And, you know, and like right now, the big current Ebola story is how that nurse Hitchcock up in wherever that is, New York or wherever, is saying she doesn't want to stay in quarantine.
Right.
And then it turns out that she has been training as a intelligence officer for the CDC. So is this part of some kind of plan, you know?
Mm.
And then when you consider that, obviously, when a pandemic breaks out, that one of the most effective preventatives is to quarantine the areas that are hardest hit by this. And yet, this hadn't been happening. Nobody has yet to try to stop the overflow of illegals coming across the southern border, and nobody has stopped plane flights coming into the United States from West Africa. And in fact, it almost seems like at the national government level that they want to spread, you know, to spread this disease.
Yeah.
We send 3,000 troops over there. Great. Let them contact it and then bring it back home to their families. You know, I mean, it's a lot of it just doesn't make much sense. But I think the key thing here is let's not panic, okay? Because if you stop and think about it, more Americans have married a Kardashian than have died from Ebola.
Yeah, well, and also now that we have an Ebola czar, I'm sure everything's going to be just fine.
Yeah, right. Except the Ebola czar, it has no medical background, knows nothing about it, except that he's a totally political appointee to do the politically correct thing. And that worries me.
Right.
I'd rather have somebody with some medical knowledge in there that can tell us what's real and what's not. And then, speaking of, let's not forget that there's about 100 microbiologists that have died under unusual and sometimes suspicious circumstances over the past few years. It's almost as though somebody wants to take out anybody who might be really, truly knowledgeable and capable of telling what's real, what's not, and particularly anybody who might be able to come up with a cure.
Yeah, right. And another thing that's got my attention on this is some researchers are saying that the tribal leaders in Africa are telling them that nobody was sick until the Red Cross showed up and started inspecting people, probably with that one special test that the CDC has that you were mentioning. But
yep.
we've seen governments infect their own people before, and especially if it's overseas.
Yeah, they've been caught at it.
Yeah.
You know, you might recall that here a year or two ago, one of the large pharmaceutical companies was sending out a vaccine for flu or whatever, and somewhere like Bulgaria, they decided to test it on some ferrets, and they all died. And so they were able to stop that. But in Belgium, they found, I think Merck was, or one of the big pharmaceutical outfits was dumping all kinds of pathogens in the water supply. So it's not like they can't or won't do that. They've been caught at it before. So I think we should be very wary about what's truly going on.
I'm with you, man. And you know, the elite love their rituals. What do you make of that updated block in the Georgia Guidestones? A lot of people have written me about that. Do you think there's a connection possibly to the start of a new plan, which could be Ebola, could be ISIS?
Well, and as I recall, there was a little block that had a 14 on it. So a lot of people were thinking that was a little tip off that they were going to start making their moves in 2014. But it's starting to get late in the year, so I guess they're going to have to hurry. But then we don't really know what all that is. All we know is the most pertinent thing about the Georgia Guidestones is that the number one admonition is they want to try to maintain a human population of 500 million on this planet. Well, okay, but wait a minute. Right now today, we're at about 7.5 billion. So if we're going to reduce the population to 500 million, what's supposed to happen to the 7 billion of us?
Right.
You know, that is kind of room for concern, I think.
Yeah, that's the scary thing.
And that's the thing that I try to get people to wake up here, because what we're discussing here, Greg, is not just some philosophical argument or some political maybe this, maybe that. You know, when you go and study the eugenics movement and the people behind it, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the moneyed elite, and then read their own words, Prince Philip, who says, well, if there is such thing as reincarnation, I want to come back as a deadly virus to help solve the overpopulation problem. you know, or you've got Maxwell Taylor, who says, yeah, in the next century, meaning today, we got to reduce the third world population. You got Henry Kissinger saying the same thing. So when these self-styled globalists are saying, you know, we need to reduce the population, this is self-defense. You know, they want us dead.
Right.
So we better start getting on the ball and figure out what's really going on and who's doing it, or they're going to figure out a way just to kill us all.
Yeah, man, they always keep me guessing. But let's jump back in time a little bit. You know, one of my favorite presentations from Contact in the Desert this year was your presentation for Our Occulted History. I loved it. Chock full of interesting facts from the beginning of human history right up to present day. And we've talked about the Anunnaki story of the Sumerian tablets quite a bit lately, but that seems to be a story that you're putting some stock into, right, Jim?
Well, that's true. I'll tell you what, there's just so much to it that it's hard to view it in any other way other than, you know, I think this is our past that we're just now becoming aware of. You realize that, well, even back in the 50s when I was in school, we basically were kind of taught that the Egyptian civilization was the world's first great, highly advanced civilization. And, well, now we know that, no, it was preceded by the Sumerian civilization, which obviously the similarities are so striking that obviously the Egyptian civilization was simply a hand-me-down from the Sumerian civilization. In fact, I was somewhat surprised because I was well aware of all these ancient civilizations such as the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Phoenicians, you know, but I always thought these were separate civilizations that had grown and, you know, grew up and fell and others came along. But what I found out was actually the history of the world has been just, they started with one great highly technological civilization that obviously then fell apart because of natural or even unnatural conditions, warfares and geophysical changes. And this is what we kind of collectively call Atlantis, okay, a prehistorical civilization. And, of course, there's still today lots of arguments over, well, where was this imaginary Atlantis? Was it an island in the Atlantic, or was it in the Caribbean, or was it, some suggested, the South China Sea, or was it Antarctica before a pole shift and it went under ice, and was it the island of Crete, was it the island of Santorini? And I think what we have here is a case similar to the story of the blind men and the elephant. You know, the blind men wanted to know about the elephant, so they went to the zoo, and one grabbed his trunk and said, oh, the elephant's like a hose. And the other one had his tail and said, no, the elephant's like a rope. And the other one was pushing against his side, and he said, no, the elephant's like a wall. Another had his ear, and he said, no, the elephant's like a fan. And so there they were, and they got to arguing and fighting with each other over what the elephant was like. And the truth of the matter was, they all had a piece of it. They were all telling the truth. And I think that's what we have with the arguments over Atlantis. I think they're all telling the truth. I think because I think the evidence points to the fact that there was once a great global civilization that fell into ruin, and then some of the technology was salvaged, and it rose again in the form of the of ancient Sumer, and then that began to crumble, and we saw the rise of the Egyptians, and then followed by the Greeks and the Romans and all of these others. And this leads then to their belief systems, which they all, there was in all of the these ancient civilizations, there was a pantheon of what we came to have come to call their gods. Although, for example, in Sumer, when they referred to the gods, they only referred to them as the Anunnaki, which literally means those who came from the heavens and landed on the earth, which implies flight. They were able to fly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what we find is that that's a common thread through all of the legends of all of the ancient primitive cultures on the world, whether it's the Australian Aborigines or the Southwest American Indians or the Indians, Hindu Indians of India, or the stone builders of Stonehenge, or the Dogo tribe in Africa. They all say that in the distant past, beings came from the sky and taught them things, taught them agriculture, taught them law, taught them language. And so, obviously, this, I think, tells us what was actually going on. And I was equally fascinated to begin to look at these so-called mythological gods. And I find that although the language changes, which means their names change, the characteristics all remain the same, which to me indicates that they were talking about living, breathing beings
right
at one point. Okay, for example, the Lord over the earth, okay, the guy in charge of the planet, according to the Sumerians, was Enlil. According to the Egyptians, he was Set. According to the Greeks, he was Zeus. And according to the Romans, he was Jupiter. But the characteristics are the same. So I think they were actually talking about the same entity, the same thing. The, for example, the goddess of love in Sumerian, a woman, Astaroth, in the Egyptian, Hathor, in the Greek, Aphrodite, and in the Roman, Venus. But they were all women, and they were all beautiful, and they all had the same characteristics. So I think that what we are getting, and what anyone can actually read about all this in any encyclopedia, the problem is it's just listed under Sumerian mythology or Greek mythology. So we tend to brush all that off because we tend to think that these are just stories that they made up. But there's a growing number of scholars who now believe that some of these stories of ancient gods that fly around in the sky and can destroy whole cities with a single weapon, and that were behind some of the wars of the gods and of the men and of the kings, that these were actually real flesh and blood beings that were here on this planet causing trouble thousands and thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes sense, and it can be very confusing to figure out, and the cover-up makes it even harder, and the Anunnaki get a pretty bad rap with gold mining, genetic engineering, and human slavery, but they can't be all bad, because apparently they taught us how to make beer, didn't they?
they did, and bless them for that. I read once that they had translated some of the ancient Sumerian tablets. These are these cuneiform tablets where they used a stylus to impress the characters into clay, and then they'd bake it. And so instead of paper, which can deteriorate and get destroyed, burn up, you know, they've got these tablets, and about 500,000 of them still exist. They're in the basements of museums all around the world, but in there, it tells that the ancient Sumerians had four types of beer, and I doubt any one of them was light.
Yeah. Man, you know, of all the aspects of history, we see so many parts of culture, courts, schools, rule of law, the systems we use, they go back so far, even to Sumeria and Egypt. And the part that I'm most interested in is probably the origins of fractional reserve banking and usury, because it's obviously one of their main tools of control today. And people are always chalking it up to the Rothschilds, but that was only a few hundred years ago. There's got to be a much richer history there, right?
Oh, it goes all the way back, yes. In fact, the two basic control mechanisms that have been used to control the human herd have been religion and fortified by a financial system, money, if you will. And the two are actually inseparable. If you think about it, in the Bible, Jesus, who they call the Prince of Peace, the one time he actually got really angry and got physical and got violent was when he was whipping up on the money changers,
mm-hmm.
the bankers of his day. And what's interesting is, you know, did he go to the bank to get these guys? No, they were in the temple. The money system was intertwined with the religion. And the idea being that God gave us, made us priests, and he also told us how to tell you how to live, and by the way, come and deposit your money here. So I think we can see that following all the way through. In fact, for thousands of years, it was religion that kept everybody in line, particularly in Western history. You can go back to the depths of the Middle Ages, and we find that it was the Roman Church that basically was the central power in the world. They even, the Pope and the Church in Rome, even told the kings and queens what to do, because they loaned them money, they kept their money, and all of the royalty needed that church support to support the idea that they were ordained by God to be rulers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and we see that all kinds of wars, for example, the Albigensian Crusade, that swept through Europe and wiped out the Cathar religion. This was not a secular expedition. This was a church army. We got the Crusades that may be continuing today, where you had the Christians against the Muslims. And so it's always been religion that has created such a problem. Although today, at least the religions of Christianity and Hinduism and Judaism, at least they pay lip service. Now, there's been millions of people killed in the name of these religions, but at least they pay lip service to the idea of love your fellow man and treat your fellow man as you would want to be treated, you know, as opposed to the Muslim religion, which quite blatantly says, you know, cut off the head of anybody who doesn't believe the way you do. So I think we can see that we still have a problem with religion. But today, the main control mechanism has proven to be financial. It's the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules.
Yeah. Man, when you analyze the history of it, I think there's a big part of your presentation was on that. And it was just so fascinating because I guess this area of Mesopotamia called Khazaria is where it all started with usury and interest. And that's really the fuel that makes the money funnel up, right?
That's exactly right. I was just reading today about this control through money is still going on, starting in 2008 and picking up speed in 2009, 2010 on up. We had this qualitative easing that was called, and basically what it was that they took tax money and tried to prop up all of the huge banks. In fact, something like $700 billion went to these banks, including many foreign commercial banks. So all the money that was supposed to stimulate the economy ended up going into the big banks. And since the 2008 financial crisis, the four largest U.S. banks, and that would be the Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, saw their total deposits increase by over $1 trillion. Huh. Thanks to the taxpayers that pumped $288 billion into these banks from the quantitative easing three. And these banks are using this money to invest in the stock market on margin. Well, this drove up the bubble, you know, which made a lot of Americans think that the U.S. economy was getting stronger, even while their standard of living was deteriorating. It's absolutely amazing. And so instead of spreading this money out in the form of loans to the middle class and to the average person, the big banks used all this tax money to invest in the stock market, the thing that caused them the problem in the first place. It's really amazing. But you have to understand, I guess J.P. Morgan himself was quoted as saying, gold and silver are money. Everything else is credit. And this is true. Most people don't realize that we've kind of been taught, and we kind of have the idea somehow, that when you go and put your money in the bank then turns around and loans that money to somebody else's interest, you know, and then they keep the interest using your money. But in exchange for that, for them getting to make money off your money, they provide you with a safe deposit place to keep your funds. And that's probably true. But the reality of it is that when you put money in a bank, they just take that money and they can take and loan out $10 for every $1 they have, because this is called fractional banking, where they only have to keep a fraction of the total money on hand in case everybody should suddenly want to draw their money out. And instead, they take money, and again, it's not just only used for making loans, but it's mostly used for investing in things. So when you put money in a bank, or particularly when you get a bank card, for example, you know, we tend to have the idea that they pull money out of their pocket and put it in your account. And so when you go down and buy a bunch of clothes and buy a car or whatever and charge it up, that somehow you're borrowing money from them. But really, it's not the case. What they do is just debit your account, okay?
Yeah.
And they create money out of thin air. Actually, it's not even money. They create debt is what it is.
Right.
And so here's some paperwork they've done, and nobody's out anything, and yet you're expected to pay it all back plus interest. And if you don't, they can come take your physical property, your home, your car. It's really an incredible system. And fortunately, more and more people are waking up to it, but not nearly enough.
Right. Yeah, it is a fascinating thing. It's almost alchemy, building something out of nothing, building extreme wealth out of nothing, really.
And, exactly. Well, you know, let me put it this way. Let's say you have $100, Greg, and I come to you and I say, hey, give me all your money. I'll keep it safe for you. Are you going to give it to me? Probably not.
Right.
But if I build a big building of steel and glass and put a big sign on it that says bank, and I say, Greg, give me your $100. You know, I'll keep it safe for you. And you go, oh, okay. Well, I get your $100. At that point, I have an asset because I've got $100 that I didn't have to begin with. But I don't keep that money. I go out and buy, speculate on stock with it. Or better yet, I go loan that $100 to Joe, okay,
right,
at 20% interest. And, okay, so at that point, that $100, which was an asset, has now gone out the door as a debit. So they offset each other. So in other words, your $100 is meaningless. You know, it doesn't mean anything to you because you don't have it. It doesn't mean anything to me because I don't have it. But if Joe honors the commitment there and he repays the $100 plus $20 interest, you know, on your money, do you get the $20?
No.
The bank gets the $20. So the bank has made $20 for shuffling papers.
Yeah. And didn't the Knights Templar, they built a bit of an empire off doing this kind of securities for banking thing too, didn't they?
That's exactly right. In fact, you could probably credit the Knights Templars with the world's first credit card situation. They, if you were in England and you decided you wanted to go on a religious pilgrimage to Jerusalem, you're going to pass through a lot of different countries, some of them friendly, some of them not so friendly. And so you'd really be concerned about trying to lug huge bagfuls of gold coin all that distance and through all those countries. So what you'd do is you'd go to the Knights Temple and deposit your gold there. They would give you a script for it, you know, roll of parchment or whatever. You take that along, and then all along through these various countries, if you needed money, you'd go to the Templar temples and then redeem for however much money you needed, and then they would deduct that from your deposit. So it was essentially like a credit card. And but yet, if you really study closely, you'll find that the Knights Templars probably didn't originate with this concept, but they picked it up from the archives and from the scrolls and the text that they were able to get hold of when they conquered Jerusalem and tunneled under what used to be the old Temple of Solomon. And Solomon had carried all, had collected all this stuff in as Solomon's treasure following the exodus of the Hebrews from ancient Egypt. So they brought the secrets out of ancient Egypt, and as I've already mentioned, the secrets of ancient Egypt were simply the hand-me-down secrets of the Sumerians,
mm-hmm.
All right, who attributed this knowledge of banking and of making beer and of law and of written language, et cetera, to the Anunnaki, those who came from the heavens.
Yeah, that ancient alien source could be why we have banks today, why we have so many debt slaves on the planet.
But exactly, because they figured out how to control the humans.
Yeah.
Whoever controls the pocketbook controls. And see, a lot of people don't really understand this because they think it's greedy old oil companies. They think it's greedy old insurance companies. What they don't understand is all of those these giant corporations are almost all beholden to this handful of major international banks that bankroll them, give them their line of credit, keep them from solvent, you know. Mm-hmm. And so whoever controls these central banks controls pretty much everything.
Right. And that's why we should definitely shine a light on this area. But there is a big dark spot in history for me because we have these original bankers of Mesopotamia have amassed great wealth and power, and then we eventually see the power shift to the British Crown, the Vatican, and the Bank of London. Are these the same people with a different wrapper, or did something change?
Well, let me just point out that the Rothschilds, who most people who've actually researched the whole thing pretty well understand, is kind of at the top of the financial pyramid. They themselves claimed to be the descendants of Nimrod, the ancient Sumerian god king. And all of the so-called rulers of the day, from the Windsors, the royal family of England, and their ancestors, which includes the Gore family, Al Gore, includes the Bush family, includes the Cheney family, includes, believe it or not, Barack Hussein Obama, who is a distant relative of Dick Cheney, according to Dick Cheney's wife. Okay, so yes, they're all connected.
Yeah, and bloodlines are obviously so very important to the elite. And one fact I jotted down from your presentation is that apparently every presidential election since the first has gone to the candidate with the most British or French royal genes. And that's pretty crazy. Is that true?
It is true.
Wow.
I first got onto that back in 2000, the selection of 2000, when George W. Bush was running against Al Gore. And the Burke's Peerage, which is a very prestigious genealogical publication in England, came out and said that because every American president had always been the one closest in the bloodline to the British royals, that Bush would take the election, would be made president, because although both he and Gore were related to the Windsors, his was the more closer relationship. And sure enough, although what is now known beyond dispute is that Gore actually won the election, but because of the hanging chads and because of all of the turmoil and the fact that they stopped recounting the votes in Florida, then they threw the whole thing to the Supreme Court, which then appointed George W. Bush as president of the United States. So it turned out that that was true. And then, like I said, what blew me away was when after that happened, and then we saw the very sudden rise of Barack Obama, it's like, well, at least we don't have to worry about him being part of this group, except then we find out through Lynn Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife, who's preparing a book on his family, that Barack Obama is a cousin of his. So it's like, holy cow, we can't seem to get away from these people.
Right. And it is fascinating to find out that that's the truth, but it would make sense if you take the position that the U.S.'s independence from Britain was totally manufactured and they just kind of started extracting wealth in secret rather than fighting it out in the battlefield, which tends to be coming out more and more.
Right.
You'd think, of course, they'd have to control the leadership, too.
Right. Well, it's the same thing I know in researching the Rothschild family. One of their most credible and prominent biographers looked into it and found that in the early 1800s, the Rothschilds sent one of their scions over to North America, and he went back and wrote that, oh man, North America is so rich in resources, people are hard working, and you know, it's an excellent opportunity for business. And yet this biographer said he was puzzled and couldn't understand why the Rothschilds failed to move into North America. Well, apparently the reality is, and the reason is, because they were already coming under suspicion and great deal of criticism because of the way that the Rothschild dynasty was running Europe at the time. Old man Rothschild had sent his sons, and they had made their way into becoming heads of the central banks in England, in France, Spain, Austria, Germany. And during that time, all these European nations had constant wars going on with each other, which, of course, did nothing but profit the Rothschilds. And so they were finally coming out with a lot of criticism for this. And I think that they realized that there's going to be the American colonists had just thrown off the British Empire. So they probably would have put up a fight if they thought the Rothschilds were trying to take over here. So what they did was they pulled a stealth move. They operated behind from front men. They sent their representatives over here, and then they also tapped local people. One of the local front men for the Rothschilds was John D. Rockefeller, who got his start in the oil business through money from the Bank of Cleveland, which at that time was a registered Rothschild bank. And, of course, by 1898 or so, John D. Rockefeller owned almost virtually the entire petroleum industry of the Western world. And in fact, it was such a monopoly that in about 1909, the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, that's a monopoly. And they broke it up. And instead of having one big, huge oil company, Standard Oil, they broke it up and created 33 oil companies, which meant that John D. Rockefeller, instead of having a controlling interest in one oil company, now had a controlling interest in 33 companies, and he quickly became the world's first billionaire.
Man, from the Anunnaki to the British Crown to John D. Rockefeller, it seems like the pattern is always it's way easier to control things in the shadows than it is to just come out there with guns on the field.
That's right. That's right. And they still do the same thing today. In Europe today, people look to the kings and queens, the Queen of Holland, the Queen of England, you know, and then in North America, here in the United States, of course, we supposedly don't have any royalty, but our presidents are more and more treated like royalty.
Right.
When Thomas Jefferson and those guys, when they were elected president of the United States, they simply walked over to the Capitol. You know, it wasn't a big deal. Today, they travel in armored, reinforced black cars and surrounded by helicopters. And, you know, they're treated like royalty. So we do have our royalty today. And yet, just like the royals back through history, they're not truly in control. This is the thing that most people are having a difficulty in understanding, is that it doesn't matter whether you vote for a Republican or a Democrat. Both parties are controlled by the same moneyed interest. And in certain areas, fiscal responsibility, foreign policy, it doesn't matter who gets in. The window dressing changes, okay? If a Republican gets in, he may be against abortions, or he may be against same-sex marriage, whereas a Democrat may be for all that, all right? So there's some window dressing that changes, but as far as fundamental changes to the corporate system, to foreign policy, to the fiscal policy of the United States, it doesn't change because they're both run by the same bunch.
Right. And yeah, there's definitely real evidence that the true power is behind the curtain. But do you think it, at the top of the pyramid, do you think it stops at the international bankers? I mean, that would make a lot of sense. But some researchers are saying that there might be something even non-human that they're listening to.
Well, I would simply quote from Karen Hughes, H-U-D-E-S, who for more than 20 years worked as a senior counsel for the World Bank. And she is now turned whistleblower, and she says the World Bank is corrupt, that it's running countries, and that it's all run by private bankers. And then she goes further and says some of these people at the top of the financial pyramid are not even human.
Wow.
And she's not the only one. Paul Hilliard, the former defense minister in Canada, says, yes, there are aliens among us, and they have contributed to our technological advancement. And he's not the only one. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, the astronaut, he has confirmed and said that, yes, we have technology that we gain from alien contact. So, and that's just a few. Of course, I have to tell you, Greg, but because you're somewhat familiar with the UFO community, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who know and understand all this. It just, you're not going to hear this in the corporate control mainstream media.
Right, right. And I definitely am fascinated by the field of ufology, but it still seems like people are always talking about Roswell or the Randlesham Forest incident, but I'm not hearing about very many things that have happened in the last decade when you think that people have more cameras than ever, and the technology, even the human technology, is probably advanced to a level that we'd think it was alien. Maybe they've just gotten better at covering their tracks.
Well, I don't think there's been any real cover-up. Just get on the internet, go to Google or any one of those search engines, type in UFO. It'll keep you busy for months.
That's true.
You know, every day goes by, there's somebody posting something on the internet showing something in the sky flying around. And yeah, I think you hit a real good point there. Today, we are so advanced in our technology, and we are so secretive. They keep everything secret today. A lot of what's flying around may actually be us using, you know, secret technology. But then it's not all us, because you can go all the way back. My idea of the smoking gun in the UFO research is concerns the spaceship crash in Aurora, Texas, which happened in April of 1897, okay,
mm-hmm.
which was like 6 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. There was nothing man-made in the air at that time. You know, growing up through the 50s and 60s, there was a great argument that a lot of the UFO sightings were simply secret government test craft, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's a valid argument that could account for a lot of it. But like I say, in 1897, there were no secret government test craft. There was nothing man-made flying in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we've got this account that was published in the Dallas-Fort Worth papers. In fact, a front page story on the Dallas Morning News, which is still in publication, that said this silver cigar-shaped object crashed in Aurora, Texas. And about the third or fourth paragraph says the pilot, whose remains were badly disfigured, but enough were recovered to show he was not an inhabitant of this world.
Whoa.
So there you have it.
Yeah, man, it's crazy out there. And I love hearing about all the different mysterious things that are found in space. Sometimes things found on the moon, pyramids on Mars. A lot of weird stuff out there. But
right.
I really do like the moon material that you had in your presentation, because we kind of take it for granted because we can see it with the naked eye. But there's a lot of strange aspects to the moon, aren't there?
Well, that's why in my book, The Alien Agenda, I refer to the moon as the greatest UFO.
Right.
It's an unidentified object in the sky. Yeah, we know it's there, and now we reportedly have been there, and we've gotten moon rocks. But what that did, about all that did, was prove that the moon did not break away from the Earth, because the moon rocks, many of them are of totally different composition than what you find on Earth.
Right.
So then we realized that the moon came from somewhere else. Now picture the Earth hanging in space, and here comes an object the size of the moon, and it passes close by the Earth, and then it gets picked up in the Earth's gravity field and gets pulled back slowly over a period of time, and then it'll go past the Earth again, and then it'll get caught in gravity, pulled back again. Now, common sense and rational thinking would tell you that, therefore, the moon should be in an elliptical orbit, kind of wobbly, going around the Earth. And yet, what we know is that the moon is in a stationary, near perfectly circular orbit around the equator of the Earth, with one side always facing the Earth. And at just the proper distance, so that when there is an eclipse of the moon to the sun, it just neatly covers just the corona of the sun. You know, how is that possible?
Right.
The great scientist Isaac Asimov says the moon shouldn't be where it is, but it is, okay? But then, Greg, this kind of shows us our circular thinking. We know there's, and we've been told there's no such thing as this alien. And we know the moon has been there as far back in written history as we can go. And so we know we didn't park it there. And we know there's no such things as aliens, so we just won't discuss it.
Right. Yeah.
Let's don't talk about the moon. And I know when I was in school, we were taught the moon was just this airless, dead world. It's just a rock up there. No magnetic field, no atmosphere, no water. And now we know all that's wrong. There is a slight magnetic field. Huge sweeps of water have been found sweeping across the surface of the moon. There is a small but detectable atmosphere. It's just the moon's not anything like what we were taught just 30 years ago.
Right. And some people are saying that now there's evidence to show it might even be hollow inside, and it has some type of creaking sound it's emitting. Very weird.
Right. Yeah. I had an opportunity to meet with Dr. Mitchell, and I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think about the idea that the moon is hollow? And right off, he just kind of huffed and went, no, the moon's not hollow. But then he continued on. He said, of course, he said, we do know that the heavier elements are on the outside, and the inside seems to be lighter in composition. And so he says, we kind of figure maybe there's giant caverns inside the moon. here's a guy that's walking the moon, a big heroic astronaut. I don't want to get into space, but I'm thinking, wait a minute, hollow moon, giant caverns inside the moon? What's the difference?
Exactly.
Still talking about hollow areas inside the moon.
Yeah. And there's actually a ton of speculation that some moons of other planets in the solar system could be hollow as well, isn't there?
That's true. The famous astronomer Carl Sagan, early in his career, along with some Russian scientists, were claiming that because of the characteristics of the moon of Mars, Phobos, that it was probably a artificial satellite. But, of course, as he gained fame and popularity and became a darling mouthpiece for the establishment, he kind of backed off of all that.
Yeah, they make you.
Oh, yeah. You got to go along with the program.
Right. Well, do you put any stock into the stories, the really weird ones out there about the hollow Earth? I mean, there's some ancient texts and oral traditions that talk about beings from inside the Earth just as beings from the sky. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, I've made a fairly cursory examination of the story of Agartha, which is the idea of an inner Earth. And quite frankly, that's still in my hump file. Okay? My hump file is this ever-growing file of information that I study and go, huh, you know, because there's enough there, there's smoke there, but I haven't been able to find the fire. And supposedly, if some of the stories of the Hollow Earth and of Agartha are true, one should be able to fly over the North Pole and over the South Pole and find this huge gaping hole that supposedly leads to the inner Earth. And yet, I don't know of anyone who claims to have any kind of documentation to show that that's true and exists.
Right. I'm kind of with you. I love the stories. I mean, I live for the Hoff file. That's where the most interesting stuff lies.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm with
It'll
you.
It'll also keep you up at night.
Right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for being here, man. You never fail to impress. We've been all over the map. You do amazing research, and you're a bit of fun, man. I like that you're still willing to have fun with it. A lot of people take these things way too seriously, and it'll be the death of them.
Well, I've kind of figured out that that what we think of as life is actually kind of a big cosmic joke, you know, and when we depart these meat sacks that we're trapped in, and we are free energy beings floating about the universe, we're going to think, boy, that was really a hoot back there on Earth. Even though at the time I was so concerned about all that stuff.
Right. Man, well, I agree with you, and I've had a great time here. But before we go, would you like to tell the people a little bit about some upcoming work you might have out there or where to keep tabs on you?
Well, I'm going to be in Dallas on November the 21st at the Texas Theater for a showing of the John Barber's film on Jim Garrison. He got the only non-censored account of Jim Garrison's trial in New Orleans from Jim Garrison, and it's really worth seeing. And then the next day, I'll be at JFK Lancer, and then that evening in Arlington at an event by Judith Baker. So if anybody's in the Dallas area wants to come get immersed in the Kennedy assassination, that's going on. And then I believe I'm going to be at the Conscious Life Expo.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be February the 6th through the 9th. And then I think I'm going to be returning to the Joshua Tree Contact in the Desert again next year.
Oh, that was such a great conference, except for when the power went out for a little bit.
Well, I think one of the problems there was they got a whole lot more people than they were expecting.
Right.
And I think it put a burden on their system. this year they're trying to, but it's interesting, Greg, how that thing has grown. 2 years ago when I first went out there and they had their first one, they were expecting maybe 300 or 400 people, and they had like maybe 600. And so that put a stress on their system, and there were a few complaints, so they worked real hard. And then last year I think they were prepared for about 900 people, and they got almost 2,000. So in a way they're really going and blowing. But you know, actually, to me, that's pretty encouraging, because that shows that there is a growing consciousness among the public to these things that we've been talking about. And I know that's true, because again, 2 years ago when I went out there, it was predominantly a UFO conference, and most people there, they were just concerned about aliens and UFOs, and they didn't really particularly want to hear about much of anything else. But then last year when I was out there, it's like there were so many more people, and they were so eager for information. And they not only wanted to know about aliens and UFOs, they wanted to know about 9/11, the Kennedy assassination, the TW-800, you know, the Flight 370. What's going on with all this stuff, you know? So I think a lot of people are becoming, have heightened consciousness about what's going on, and that's good, because we all need to start paying attention and contributing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whatever it is you can. Okay, Greg, you're doing your radio program. I'm writing some books. Everybody can do something, even if it's hosting a neighborhood get-together or a book club or writing a letter to the editor or calling your local TV station, holding their feet to the fire and saying, hey, you're telling me that you are the best news in town. How come you didn't cover this and this and this, you know? And just, you know, just get active and try to make this world a better place.
Mm-hmm. You're here. And drink a little while we do it.
Oh, yeah. It never hurts.
Awesome, Jim. Well, keep doing what you do. This has been a real pleasure. Take care of yourself out there. Hopefully I'll see you in either L.A. or maybe at Contact again next year. And, yeah, just be careful out there, man. Don't step on any of the wrong toes.
Avoid the landmines. Okay. Thanks a lot. Adios.
Take care. There you have it, folks. I loved it. I'm fascinated by the history of banking and how cultures have been manipulated and turned against each other and infiltrated from within, and the anomalies in space, ancient aliens, the pyramids, all the fun stuff. And Jim has such a good, open-minded, casual approach to these things, but he's so knowledgeable. I think we should all be taking the generalist approach and toning down some of the rhetoric of how sure we are about one aspect of this thing or another. For my money, there's just too much manipulation for me to be sure about anything. I take the pieces I find most interesting or reasonable from this guest or the other guest and try to make some kind of sense out of this mess. And sometimes I'm more confused than when I started, but maybe that's a personal problem. It is tough, because so many of us in the conspiracy community talk about wanting to be free from slave banking and want the embargo on free energy lifted, and we get into this idea of a better future where these needs are provided abundantly for free, but then we're worried about socialism, and we realize that managing a system of distribution is a lot of power and creates a vulnerability for the society. But we have to free people from slave wage jobs. We have to give them their lives back. We have to allow technology to handle every job it can and allow ourselves to focus on the experience we came here to have. And I've had the luckiest and greatest year of my life with this show and the guests and the fans. And my lovely supportive lady and I just got back from the best celebration preparatory trip of my life, because it's always that you can't get the time away from work, or you don't have the money because you're not working. And finally, after many years of working this job and a full-time slave job, I've had a little bit of both, time and money. So granted, we did stay in the car most nights, one being near Mount Shasta, trying to see something strange in the sky, which we never did see, but it was still great. Spent some time in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, which are all amazing cities that I'd never been to before. Went to Crater Lake, which was amazing. It is a giant, still, tranquil lake that people commonly think was formed by a meteor impact because of the name Crater Lake, but that's a misconception. Actually, it was a giant volcano that blew itself up completely over 8,000 years ago and left a huge, huge crater, and the snow from the surrounding mountaintops melted into the hole over time and has formed the deepest lake in the States. It's amazing, and I'd recommend a day there for anyone. Spent some time with some listeners at a few places, namely Lou from Lifted Labs in Portland, who specializes in medical marijuana concentrates, and I had a really good time there. Thanks again, Lou. And all the listeners and subscribers that think I put on a show worthy enough of the $5 tip every month, I'll never take that for granted, and I'll always work hard to put on an honest and interesting show that's worth your time and money. In the extended show for this week, I talked to Jim more about the strange sights in America, like the Rock Wall and Rock Wall, Texas, UFOs and free energy, a lot deeper look into who the Zionists are and how it all got started and how we went from Rothschild's Rockefeller. It's an interesting breakdown, a little racy, but it's all good-natured, and we want to understand these people. And we talk about police brutality and militarization, and also what type of system Jim feels we should try to work towards if we could all get out from under the puppet master's thumb. I love it, and I'm sure you all did too. A few weeks ago, I played a song called Old Friend by a listener named Don Paul Moore, and it seemed to be pretty well liked, and Don didn't have any links up at the time. Now he has a SoundCloud, so you can check out Don Paul Moore on SoundCloud. And he sent me another song this week. This one's called Mr. Morgan's War, and Don writes that this song is about J.P. Morgan's abuse of power and how he helped to sway the American public into involvement in World War I, as reported to Congress a few years after the fact. He bribed and paid off several dozen of the most influential newspaper editors in the country to print wild claims about the Germans, and although they may not have been Boy Scouts, it just goes to show how the media can sway folks, and also how psychopaths like J.P. Morgan view us as cattle. Amen, Don, and I'm glad you're putting out entertainment that touches on that stuff. I think education and art and entertainment and humor and music are the best ways we can learn, expose, bob our heads, and laugh at this big thing and all it entails. And I'm so happy to play Don's song. I think it fits in with this episode particularly well. And again, you can check out Don Paul Moore on SoundCloud. Let them know you liked it, and also let our guests know when you liked their appearances. They like to hear that it made an impact and that there's a real audience out there. They're not just talking to me. That way we can make sure they always want to come back and feel like it was worth their time. And with all that said, guys, it is great to be back into this routine. A new Money Bomb is starting this month, and the Plus Show is ripe for your taking. So that is it for me this week. I've done all I can, and it's your move, shadowy twisters of the historical timeline, concealers of the mysteries of man, and corrupt puppet masters of the pyramid of global control. Your fucking move.
Mr. Morgan, the world must know of the lives that you have taken. Your psychotic dreams caused the world's humanity to be forsaken. With your sick and twisted and blackened views, the role of God was played by you. But I want you and your kind to know that soon all of my kind will know that gone are the days of freedom. No one has their own thoughts anymore. Take our sons and daughters, and they feed them to the CEOs behind the boardroom doors. The monsters have found ways to hide in broad daylight before our eyes. They bribed us out of our perceptions, these masters of the mass deceptions. They've dumbed us down with skin and flesh.
stuff. I think it's time we've had enough. If we could crash their two-way mirrors, we'll see those wizards shake in fear. But gone are the days of freedom. No one has their own thoughts anymore. They take our sons and daughters and they feed them to the CEOs behind the border doors. Step up to the well, my friend, that you might start to comprehend. Steal your soul and look beyond the surface of the water. Those with eyes, Lord, let them see the violence and brutality caused by those who lead the trusting sheep down to the house of slaughter. With the truth that we know